at a time. I'm having trouble believing that a ground station talking to a satellite is going to be putting out full RF power for 6 solid minutes. So the timing of radio frequency biohazard could work to your advantage. The power radiated might sound dangerous, but if it's for brief enough periods, it might become safe. There is a possibility of that one, George. KD2FIU, K2LIW.
And that's what we know today.
Well, hold on now. You've got the C95 report of radio frequency biohazard, the defining document for the United States. It represents 50 or 60 years of research on radio frequency biohazard. It's updated every couple of years. It's got 1,000 references. It represents the best thinking of the best testing laboratories and institutions. It's got 60 years of history. And there's a similar document for the United Kingdom, for Scandinavia, for Japan, and they all hang together. That is a defining document for the NIOSH, OSHA, Department of Defense. So when you say we don't know very much, you can definitely find a website where some alarming person is telling you we don't know. And they use as previous examples of asbestos and cigarette smoking and whatever. When it comes to radio and the C95 report, done by the National, what is it now? All of a sudden I can't think of the name of the organization. It's part of the IEEE, National Institutes of Science and Technology, NIST. No, it's not that. It's another group. Anyhow, there's 60 years of research on that one. You can't say we haven't, that they're suddenly going to make a brand new discovery. That's rather unlikely, even though you can definitely find alarmist websites saying that, George. KD2FIU, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
No, I this is not up to a politician, but look at it, I'm looking at it and saying we don't know. If we're going to accelerate utilization to that degree, we're going to take, what, 60 years? Yes, we have 60 years. We may have 80 years. We may have 100 years of it. But if we're going to say, let's multiply this by 10 or 20 times over 6 years, we don't know what it's going to bring.
C2IS query.
When you say multiply it, are you talking about the strength of the signal, the number of hours of duration? What's being multiplied? You didn't make that clear, George. I'll pick up with the new person in a minute. Go ahead, George.
Yes, the number of hours of duration does not have to be coming from my individual user device. It doesn't have to be coming from your device to you.
Okay, I think I heard Bill in there. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, this is Bill, AC2IS. I was wondering what project you guys are talking about with Google satellites. I've been doing some searching, and I have not found anything in regard to Google satellites and internet access, although there are a lot of things about Google satellites for imaging purposes, and also about Google Loon, which is using ISM frequencies, the lower ISM frequency being 2.4 gigahertz in that range, and that working with basketball-sized antennas on the ground. But again, that's Google Loon, and then if there are satellites for internet connectivity, maybe they're linking back to the Google Loon project, and then from there to ground stations, AC2IS.
Paul, you mentioned the name of this satellite system, WS2N, K2IW.
Yes, what I know of is OneWeb, and that's by Branson. He's been thinking about doing it. There's another one by SpaceX that has a proposed system that sounds very similar to OneWeb, and I think they're going to compete who could get it done first. I don't know the Google one. I know Andy, WA2CDL, apparently has seen that in a recent magazine, Scientific American. So, guess Google's involved in it as well. One other comment, we talked about this on the net a while back. I had gone to Vanderbilt Planetarium, the Iridium 33 satellite intersected with Cosmos, a Russian satellite, many years ago, probably around, I think, 2008 or 2009, and they had a good show on in the Vanderbilt Planetarium, and that was one of the topics they covered. The Iridium just had a problem. One of the Iridiums just had a problem. I think one of their batteries blew up or something. Maybe that's the one that might be talking about. Battery blew up in space. Left a couple of parts flying all over. Back to you, Dick.
So I guess Bill should be looking up SpaceNet 1. That was the name of it, Paul? Repeat that one for me again.
That was... Web one, I think it was, by Branson is the one he's involved with it. Richard Branson. Now, Richard Branson.
Okay. With those new words, you may find that Bill, we just can't put up enough satellites. I'm going to break away into a slightly different subject, Paul. When it comes to rocket power, when you take the fuel and the oxidizer and you mix them together, they explode on contact. That's what hypergolic means. However, when I mix together hydrogen and oxygen, or I mix together kerosene, 39A, before the launch takes place, you see this great big spark generator turn on to make sure you're getting ignition. When I do a re-ignition in space, a re-burn in space, how does that ignition take place? WS2N, KQRIW?
Yeah, for instance, Falcon 9, when they go up and they want to reignite their second stage, they have TTEB, I think it's called TEA and then TEB. Triethylene boron, and that was the TEB one. I forgot what the TEB A stands for, but those two, when they mix together, instantaneously, they ignite. And that's what they use to restart their engines. They actually use it on the first stage, too, for igniting the first stage. But the tanks for that are on Launch Complex 40 and on Launch Complex. Because they only have to ignite them once, and off they go. Or even if they have a shutdown for a problem, they have to reignite. They use the TTEP tanks, that are on the ground to reignite the first stage. But up in the air, yeah, when they have to relaunch it, reignite that second stage, especially now with reusability, they had to relocate from the ground to the first stage, drop it. Those tanks also now have to be on the first stage because now he wants reusability. You've seen him launch these first stages and they've landed on the barges out in the middle of the ocean or back at Cape Canaveral. He has to reignite those things three different times. One to burn back, start going in the opposite direction, another one to slow himself down as he's going through the atmosphere, and another one more time right before he lands on the barge. So the T-tab is lighting, and that's what you see is that green color. The sparking thing that you see, all the sparks, that's different. That's magnesium gas fuel that might be leaking out and not going in the right direction. They want to make sure that's ignited so it doesn't go up the side of the booster or something. You see that with the space shuttle. Back to you, Dick.
Now, when you get a chance, Paul, pound your fist on that particular transmitter. It's starting to put out a little bit of a rumble on its phase lock loop system. I'm listening to you on the input, and I can hear the rumble coming out of your transmitter. Mine does that once every month or two, and I hit it with a fist and the problem goes away. not quite sure what it is. Yeah, TEB, tetraethyl borane, is what's used on the SR-71. The fuel they used, I think it's called J-7 fuel, or JP-7, the fuel that they use on that aircraft is such a low volatility fuel. In other words, you take a cup of it and stick a match, a lit match into it, and it'll put out the match. You have to carefully vaporize the fuel, heat it up, and to ignite that engine, they squirt this TEB into the engine, and that ignites it. TEB is a very fancy chemical substance that it explodes on contact with air. And so I guess you don't always have air inside of a rocket engine in space, and that's why you got TEA and TEB, something like that, Paul. So they create a hypergolic mixture to ignite the engine. They don't depend. I expected you to tell me they got a spark plug. Apparently a spark plug is nowhere near enthusiastic enough. That TEB, you squirt that into an engine, and you get a great big blue flame, fancy-looking blue flame coming out of the back end and back of a SR-71. WS2N, K2LAW on the TechNet.
Well, there are some engines. Your old J2s, flew on the Saturn V, the second stage. They had electric spark ignition. As well as the RL-10s, I was telling you before, they had the RL-10BZ, not a, I think they're up to D, or RL-10Ds. They're the second stage on the Atlas rockets, and I believe they're also the second stage on the Delta rockets, the Delta IV rockets. And they have a spark igniter, and they have liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. So, yeah, some rockets do have that. Thank you, Jim.
The rumble of your transmitter went away. What did you do to make it go away, Paul? Go ahead. K2LAW.
I pray, so I'll have to throw money at this thing and buy another one. I get some kind of feedback. If I move the speaker one way or the other, so I don't know, it might be some kind of noise coming out of the speaker line. Maybe I'll put a different cable in there. We're going from the rig to the, I use an external speaker. Once in a while, I can hear that too, crackling away. Only when I transmit, so maybe I'm getting RF into that cable.
Yeah, but you did something to make it go away. I told you to hit the rig with a fist. That's what I have to do with my rig. You just moved your speaker and the problem cleared up between the last two transmissions?
I'm in a rolling chair. I pushed myself about a foot and a half away from that speaker, further away from that speaker.
Okay, did I hear somebody else wants to make a comment?
Yeah, Dick, it's George, KD2FIU. No, the Google satellite just drifted away from his location. That's why he doesn't have the interference.
That makes sense. So, you'd be amazed how many people who have an awful strong fear of RF radiation, that word, radiation. And they think RF and radiation is similar to nuclear radiation. And it's too bad that in the early days of radio, when they were discovering how it worked, they didn't call it radio transmission or radio signaling. The fact that they called it RF radiation has created an awful problem. And so there are certain people who don't want to be near any kind of radio equipment for fear that it's going to be giving them cancer and other kinds of dangers. There's an amazing amount of RF energy that a human being can be exposed to as far as strength of the signal you pick up with a receiver is concerned. You know, volts of signal that a receiver would be overloaded with that is relatively safe for a human being at radio frequencies within reason. But the amount of energy you get from the sun, watts per square meter, compared to what you get from a radio signal hitting a human being creates thermal heating. After 60 years of research of the American National Standards Institute, C95 report, they have not confirmed any other reaction other than a thermal reaction. The RF energy gets absorbed and turned into heat. and essentially nothing else has been documented that creates a disadvantage. I can understand how you might disagree with that, George. I'll give you a chance to give a rebuttal if you'd like. KD2FIU, KQIW, and the TechNet.
Oh, Dick, I agree. I agree because even before I said we're exposed to much more just by being exposed to the sun. And also, keep in mind, I learned the word radiation. It also has to do with the intensity of heat emitted from the top of a radiator with pressurized steam coming out of, off of cast iron metal. So radiation is commonly used as a word, but I do agree, and I did mention it earlier, we are exposed to a lot more with the sun. KD2FIU, over to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that this KU-band uplink system is being proposed for the customer to talk to a satellite or a school to talk to a satellite. With a little bit of care, there are ways of keeping that pretty safe, I think. And lots of things we use that you think are safe, if you strongly misuse them, they can become unsafe. A child that decides to start experimenting with a ordinary light-emitting diode flashlight, and he decides to hold it up against his eye with his eyelid closed as an experiment. You know, he's got this flashlight, he's taking it to bed with him and he's experimenting with it. He could create eye damage with an incandescent bulb flashlight held up against the eye for a long enough period of time. So, and there are college students that get into hazing competitions where who could drink the most amount of water in some given amount of time. And large amounts of water ingested can put you at risk of a life-threatening situation. So there are lots of things in life that under normal circumstances are pretty safe, but you push them to the limit and you can do some pretty unsafe things. So we got to be careful. Okay, so ignition of those engines, I now understand that a little bit better. And so you're saying that some of those rocket engines literally have something like a spark plug in there because they didn't want to go through all the rigmarole of putting in TEB and TEA and Paul, WS2N, K2LIW.
I guess it was designed so many years ago, they probably started with that. I don't know the reason for it, but I would imagine that once they did it, I don't know, like, you know, the RL-10 by Aerojet, Rocketdyne has been around for decades. You know, it's flown Galileo to Jupiter, it's flown Ulysses around the polar orbit and around the sun, and it's just so successful, Magellan. You know, I guess they don't want to argue with success. Yeah, I'm not sure even if... I think they did have T-TAB fuel mixes. I think they used that for the lunar missions when they were going to leave the lunar surface. They needed something reliable, so that was the two fuels mixed, and they were just ignited. You did not need an igniter for that. Maybe hydrogen is more easy to ignite, more dependable to ignite than maybe the kerosene fuels. That could be one of the reasons. Don't know for sure. Back to you.
You know, I think you just hit it, Paul. The SR-71 is flying on a very low volatility kerosene-like fuel. And there you need a real hot blast to ignite that engine. That's why they're using tetraethylborane, TEB. I'm almost positive you could not start that engine with a spark plug. I'm pretty sure it wouldn't work. The fuel has to be vaporized, well mixed with air, and compressed and heated. And even then, you need a real good blast of the TEB to really reliably ignite it. Now, when it comes to the little bitty reaction control jets, reaction control miniature rocket engines, You've got all kinds of spacecraft to do positioning, to aim the spacecraft in the right direction. Those reaction control jets, what is the major fuel that they use, Paul? And how do you make sure that that miniature rocket engine gets lit? I'm about to guess that you're going to tell me they use hypergolic fuels. That once mixed together, they automatically ignite. WS2N, KQLIW.
Yeah, I know they work on hydrazine, and then they have essentially laughing gas. You know, it's those two things are mixed together. And that's how they ignite all these. That's the fuel and the oxidizer. It's really like laughing gas. That's the oxidizer, and now the problem with the fuel, if you use hydrazine, it's very good, but it's also carcinogenic, poisonous. You know, you don't want to inhale this stuff or get it on you. So when you see, saw the shuttle landing, right after they landed, they'd go out there, you'd see the guys out there preparing, you know, they want to prepare the shuttle before they bring it back to the hangar. And they were out there in these suits, they looked like space suits, you know, they were like almost like hazmat suits. They didn't want to get near this, any fuel that might be, you know, that hydrazine fuel that might be out there. So that was one of the problems. So that when you see Dream Chaser go up in a couple of years, and that'll be bringing cargo to the International Space Station, it looks like a small shuttle. That'll be coming back and landing. Let me drop it. Using a green fuel, I forget what they call it, but their reaction jets won't have that hydrazine system, and you'll be able to walk right up to it. No problem. Wash it off, fill it up, and launch it again. Back to you.
So there's got to be reaction control jets on something like Voyager. Voyager was launched, I think it was 1977, 38 or 39 years ago. So you're telling me there's a tank of hydrazine and another tank of nitrous oxide or something like that, and these two tanks still have fuel to do that reaction control jet firing periodically to aim that spacecraft 38 or 39 years downrange. There's enough fuel in that tank. The valves turning on and turning off, none of the valves have become unreliable, no leaks in the system. That's an amazing, I mean, that's a very, what's the word for that? Caustic fuel, an exotic fuel, 38 or 39 years downrange, still being used successfully. What reliability that represents. Back to you for a comment on that one, Paul, on Voyager. How the hell did Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 not have a failure of that very complicated system after all these years? WS2N, KQLIW.
Yeah, they use something, they call it deadband maneuvering. It just doesn't move in space. I mean, it just, you know, if they had to turn it for whatever reason, they can. I think I remember they have like 30% of the fuel left. But this deadband positioning system that they use, I'll have to research that again. Pretty much makes it where it really doesn't move in space. So they don't need all that much fuel. And they still got like 30% left. Well, probably bail is the batteries, RTG, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators. The thermal couplings themselves will probably degrade, and probably before they even run out of plutonium on board that's fueling that. So I expect it to go up to it. They said around 2038 now. And with the increased ability to receive the signals here on Earth, they keep improving these dishes over the decades. They expect to maybe hear from it up until 2038. That's a long time from now. Dick, back to you.
Does Voyager contain any inertial wheels? That dish is like 10 feet diameter, 8.5 gigs. The beam with the dish has got 46 dB of gain. It's got 8/10 of a degree of beam width. So to aim at the Earth accurately, to transmit that signal back down from Voyager, you've got to be within a couple of tenths of a degree of azimuth and elevation aimed at the Earth with this pencil beam, very sharp antenna. To keep that kind of accuracy, you ain't got no dead zone in there, if you know what I mean. So there must be some inertial wheels. The reason why you use a reaction control system is to unwind the inertial wheel as they start spinning up to maximum speed to give you the right direction. So, does Voyager contain any inertial wheels? And if so, how have they lasted so long, where the ones on the Hubble Space Telescope have to be replaced so often? WS2N, K2RIW?
I know they have them, but they very seldom use any of it. It's this dead band. I'll have to look that up. I think it's called dead band positioning. Some way of keeping the whole thing steady. You know, it doesn't rotate, just stays in one position. I guess with the antenna facing back. By the way, it's a 12-foot dish that they have. So, and they used to have all this gimbaling method system on board for the cameras and everything. You know, as they went past the planet, they were supposed to move and take pictures of the planet. Well, they're all locked up. Excuse me, they're all locked up early on, and they could use that. So they figured that they would rotate the, you know, move the spacecraft just so that the planet would stay in focus, you know, as they went by. They wouldn't lose the planet, the moon, whatever they were looking at. And they used a little extra fuel for that, but even with that, they said that they still have like 30% left. It's unbelievable. But, you know, it's not only one, they have two. There's two Voyagers out there, and they're both still working. And they still communicate a couple of times a week. You look on that deep space network, and any time I look, every now and then, I see Voyager, you know, coming down. Back to you, Dick.
Now, Voyager, when they studied its velocity versus time, they discovered that it was slowing down too fast. It was decelerating. I'm talking about micro amounts of deceleration compared to its ridiculous speed of 40,000 miles an hour or whatever it is, and they eventually discovered that the electronics on the back of the dish radiating heat into space represents an extremely small amount of thrust. Well, that electronics behind the dish radiating in space, I guarantee that they hadn't calculated that ahead of time, and is that the thrust that they're getting, a thoroughly symmetric thrust? Very unlikely. It's got to be a thrust a little bit off to one side. Therefore, you've got to use the reaction control jets periodically to re-aim. A 12-foot dish at 8.5 gigahertz has got something like 6/10 of a degree, plus or minus 3/10 of a degree is the half power point on the aiming of that dish. To aim that precisely at Earth in azimuth and elevation with a non-symmetric thrust coming off the heat of the electronics on the back of the dish means that they have fired those jets many thousands of times, and they keep working reliably, and you're not sure whether or not they've got inertial wheels on board. That would drastically lower the number of firings. But if they don't have inertial wheels, how else can they orient that spacecraft to make sure it's aimed at the Earth? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, I couldn't find whether or not they had inertial wheels. I think, I mean, they just use them so little. Like I said, they just keep it steady. It's called dead band reckoning or something. And they have to make adjustments very, 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 very small. In other words, it's going in one direction. If it starts, it starts to tilt one way or the other, you know, maybe a month or two from now, ignite the, you know, some small thruster, and maybe readjust it, but they just keep it steady like that, and it's worked out. Nowadays, NASA has perfected a new kind of thruster. I would have liked to have seen this on Voyager. That would have really helped. And it's called, they're actually micro thrusters, but it's really called disturbance reduction system that they're using. And first time they used it, we talked about this many nights ago. And it's on a spacecraft now that's at the L1 position. And it was launched by a European Space Agency. It was a complete European Space Agency project, but NASA did sign on to develop these thrusters. Drop it.
Is that an ionic engine, though, Paul?
Oh, no, it's not. These thrusters are so small that they said it's the equivalent of, like, having this 1,000-pound spacecraft out in the middle of nowhere and having a little mosquito land on it. That's the amount of thrust. It's so small, I forget how many micro newtons this thing is, but it's way down in. And they put it on this spacecraft. It's called Pathfinder LISA demonstration. They launched it from a Vega rocket from French Guiana, South America, about a year and a half ago, and it went out to the L1 position, and it's staying in one position, and inside of it, they have these weights, and they want to keep them perfectly still. The idea is eventually to prove out a technology that, you know, these weights will eventually be able to detect gravitational waves, but to keep this spacecraft so perfectly still that they didn't want the, let me drop it, want the sun's, the light from the sun, or maybe solar wind or anything that touches the spacecraft to affect the movement of the spacecraft. So to compensate for that small amount of possible movement, they needed these nano thrusters. So they developed these things, and it just like boils off a, they say microscopic and microscopic, like droplet, you might say, and that's what goes out of these thrusters. They have 8 thrusters on board the spacecraft to keep it steady. So if the spacecraft starts to go one way or the other, they don't want it to move. And now these 2 weights inside the spaceship that are floating will always stay perfectly relative to one another. And if a gravitational wave comes by, it would, you know, theoretically be able to detect that. And there's a certain sensitivity that they were hoping for. And whatever that sensitivity was, they beat it by 5 times that amount. So it's been a very successful flight. But the results came back on these thrusters that NASA developed. And they came back on 100% back in there.
In order to get thrust, you have to take some kind of particle that's got some mass to it and accelerate it and move it away from your spacecraft. Newton's third law, action and reaction. So you're boiling off something, which means you're consuming a fuel of some kind. You would think that a micro thruster, a nano thruster, maybe could be done by sending out a light beam. Photons have got a very small amount of mass. And if you could aim a light beam in some direction to get thrust out of it, that would be a method of thrusting where you're not going to run out of fuel as long as you've got ways of making the electrical power to run that light generator. So, this nano thruster you're describing, how long does the fuel last, do you think, Paul? And has anyone ever discussed using a light beam as a nano thruster? WS2N, K2RIW?
That might work good. This one here, I found my paper on it. It was 1/10 of a micronewton. And then a full blast would have been 30 micronewtons. So it's just some blue. They use some kind of ionized droplets. Ionized droplets. They're accelerated by an electric field. I guess you would consider it some kind of an ion thruster. Maybe you could. Droplets. And that's how they get their thrust. Back to you, Dick. I think I heard another station.
Yeah, we lost the 375 repeater for a short period of time. We got to be careful with not to time out, because that thing will quiet down on us if people trying to listen to IRLP or Echolink don't hear anything. So you have reason to believe that this nano thruster will have fuel that will last for a very long period of time, Paul, because it's using so little of the fuel. W, Paul, KQRIW.
Yeah, they say that microscopic little liquid drops, and it's called electrospray, electrospray technology. So, probably have a shot glass that'll probably last you forever. So, that's how they're doing it. Now, if you want to look it up, the project was called ST7 and then -DRS. So, but that's, I guess, NASA speak for whatever it was called. Jet Propulsion Laboratory was involved with it. So, that's pretty good. So, now, because of that, we get some of the information from the European Space Agency. You know, we make a deal with these people. We'll give you, in this case, these micro thrusters, which were never really flown in space before, but now they can be used on other space projects. Now that they're proven, and European Space Agency's happy, and we're happy. So, I mean, maybe 10 years down the road, they might have another flight. The idea is to have like two of these things separated by like a million miles, and somehow have these weights, I'll use the word, communicate with each other with laser beams, and they'll be able to detect if a real gravitational wave goes by. But they just want to see if they have the capability of keeping these things steady with inside of a spacecraft, like taking a shoebox and putting two weights and floating them inside. And we want these two weights to stay exactly where they are. And if somebody moves the outside of that shoebox, we need little thrusters to compensate for that, so they don't hit the walls on the inside of the craft.
For a micro thruster to be efficient, you want to use a very small amount of fuel, and the particles that you're emitting to create thrust, you want them to be at very high velocity. And now you're getting a good efficiency out of that micro thruster. What's the method that accelerates those particles to a high velocity? Just boiling them off it's going to give you thrust, but that's very inefficient thrust. Is there a mechanism in there for taking those boiled off particles of these micro droplets and accelerating through a very high speed, a little bit like an ionic engine? W, Paul, KQRIW.
Yeah, they're not calling it an ionic engine, but it sounds like one to me. You know, they have an electric field that takes these little droplets and they kind of like, I guess they become ion. They definitely become ionized, the droplets. And then there's another second field, another electric field that has an opposite charge that'll push them out of the thruster. Never been too sure on how that works. Even with the ion rockets, you know, you push it out, you need some kind of counteraction to make sure that these things eventually don't come back at you. They don't talk about that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, your charged particles that you're accelerating have to be accompanied by the opposite charged particles being emitted to make sure you don't build up a charge. Because if you build up a big enough charge on your spacecraft, everything you send out there will turn around and come back at you. I'll make you unhappy. This micro thruster is beginning to sound like a super miniature ionic engine, because you've got to accelerate those particles to a high velocity to use them efficiently. One other thing I was going to bring to your attention is the November issue, 2016, the November issue of NASA Tech Briefs, on page 6, has an unusual article that's entitled Home Sweet Mars. NASA is offering a $1.1 million prize for the Phase 2 three-dimensional printing habitat challenge. In other words, for people who are able to take the indigenous materials on something like Mars, put them into a 3D printer, and generate a habitat. That's what I understand is this project, $1.1 million prize. So NASA is still thinking pretty positively about sending pioneers to colonize Mars. You know, my feeling on that is that it's not so likely, but I know that just about every high school student is positive that colonizing Mars is one of the next steps for a major space adventure. Over to you, Paul, WS2N, KQIW.
That guy, Red NASA had something like that. Rings a bell. They run a lot of competitions for different things. And then it's good for a lot of young people and interested in this topic. But, if they have the ability now to and money to get to Mars, it's only going to take a little bit more money, especially if they take some away from the the global warming satellites to reinstitute that moon program. I think that would be the way to go. Because then you could land there and you could practice taking the ground, the material, the regolith out of the soil of the moon and trying to make rocket fuel out of it. I mean, to some extent that they want to do that on Mars, you know, actually be able to refuel said things or get oxygen and hydrogen out of the planet. So why not go to the moon and do the same thing and practice a little closer to home? I still want to set up an outpost there. I'm going to see a couple of hands up there that we could electronically send QSL cards back and forth to the moon. I can't end this net without talking about the Mars show. Part 2 is going to be on tomorrow night, 9 o'clock, National Geographic Station. And Part 1 was on last week, and a lot of the topics and things that they talk about, some of the things that we talk about quite a bit here on the space.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Timed out.
Yeah, what was the first version last week like, Paul? I guess there's a way to see it on YouTube video, wasn't there? And do you know what the subject is going to be this week? Tomorrow, I think you said. Go ahead.
Somebody told me that you could just bring up the National Geographic website and, you know, you just go to the thing that says Mars. It basically has the name of the show, Mars, so you click on that. I guess there's a way to find I know you can click on different parts of the show, you know, almost like little trailers, but then there's supposed to be one thing that you can click on the episode that was just on. Sit there and watch the whole thing. It's not only an hour. For me, it's a little bit less. I sip through the commercials. You better off recording these things. So, yeah, it was, they were talking about, they interviewed some people, Elon Musk. They interviewed Anne Duran, the widow of Carl Sagan. She's very active in this type of thing. So, they do have actors, actresses playing the parts of somebody going to Mars. And I wish they would have shown the launch better. Let me drop it. You just see a cloud of smoke going up. They didn't show the launch vehicle. I was disappointed in that. So, you know, it's almost like taking it from orbit. And so now they're on the way to Mars. And they got to the part where they're going to land. And they have some problems. Land in the wrong location. Which is possible, you know. That even goes on Earth. The Chinese, when they came back today, wound up last night. They came back 100 kilometers off their location. So I guess that wouldn't be too hard to do on Mars too, which is a serious problem because their main camp is too far away. They're supposed to land right on top of the camp because that's where all their supplies are. So you know how this movie's gonna go. Back to you, Dick.
35, Paul. We're about to run out of time. You guys are just listening to TechNet number 1628, Space Report number 228. We'll be back next week and discussing some more of these issues. Got to turn it over to John for him to tie the ribbons on this one. And look out for those mailbag requests you're going to get, Paul. I mean, John. The next one's going to be a whopper. KC2WGB, KQLIW.
KC2WGB. Oh, I'm sure. We get them a couple of times a month. We get some real interesting questions. But I'd like to thank everybody for joining us on the net and for submitting questions and participating. It's always a pleasure to serve. And, gentlemen, thank you for your time. KC2WGB. Over to you, Paul.
Very good, John. We'll catch you next week, if not during the week. And everybody have a good Thanksgiving. Catch you next time around. Back to you, Dick. WS1, clear.
Yeah, but before colonizing the moon, Mars, you want to do a practice run on the moon. And the first huge problem you got with putting anybody on the moon for a length of time is a ridiculously high temperature at high noon and ridiculously cold temperature at midnight on the moon. That's a tough problem to solve. You got to solve that one before you can put anybody there for any more than a couple of days, Paul. Thank you for any comments on that. Bye-bye for now. KQLIW.
I know it, but they always say on a space station, the hardest part is getting rid of the heat inside this thing. It's very well insulated. It's almost too well insulated. There's a vacuum between the outer walls, mylar insulation in between. You know, just that body heat and the electronics inside gives off a lot of heat. Yeah, I understand that. You know, they go hot, cold, and hot, cold, and you know, 16 sunrises a day and all. But wow. Well, we'll see. I mean, I think they'll work it out sooner or later. The Russians, they've already chickened out a little bit. They were planning on 2025, now they're looking at 2030. So maybe they're worried about the temperatures, the hot and cold temperatures too, Dick. Back to you, and then I'm going to clear.
Okay, we'll solve that problem next week. Bye-bye for now, Paul, and the crew. Bye-bye, you all.
Good night, gang. Enjoy it, Keith. You guys.
Where are you located now? In the middle of Pennsylvania, Rich?
Yeah, pretty close. I'm in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, which is about maybe 20, 30 miles further from New York than Harrisburg is, where I also go, but not too far from Hershey, Pennsylvania right now.
Did you see any snowstorms while you were out to the west?
Yes, I did. I had the heavy blowing snow and ice in New Jersey Saturday night, and then some more snow in Ohio covering the ground, and just today now coming out of Louisville, there was a lot of heavy winds of more snow in Ohio, and a light flurry that was pretty much the whole time I was in Pennsylvania was light flurries. And the temperature was down to about 23 at one point. It's up to 37 now.
Of all the places you've traveled through in the last few days, what's the most amount of snow you saw on the ground? 3 or 4 inches, maybe?
No, I'd say maybe 1, 2 max. And that's on, it wasn't on the road surface because they had salted it, so the roads were dry. But, you know, once you get up on the grass edges and parking lots and stuff, that had 1, possibly 2 inches down. But nothing too big, nothing too accumulative yet.
Rich, you didn't have very much trouble keeping your windshield clean? Or does the salt pile up on your windshield and the light gets complicated?
KTUPS. Oh, no, we definitely got a mess of our windshield. We had a problem we had to fix as soon as we got to Kentucky, because the washer fluid hose on the driver's side wiper broke at the base. So when you hit the button to put fluid on the windshield, the passenger side got sprayed real nice, and the driver's side just dumped all out and came out on the ground. So we had to have that serviced. That got pretty dicey for a while there. I had to stop periodically and go out and manually spray stuff on the windshield. I don't know if you copied that last tape, but I'm not getting any more from you now. I guess I think they're shutting down KTUPS mobile.
Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Net tonight at 8:30. WQVL Repeater System.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL amateur radio repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. WQVL repeater system. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater.
Into EO, into EO, into MB Mobile.
Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL amateur radio repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. WQVL repeater system.
Back from you, so maybe I'll just copy it to that email address.
You have one at Limark, huh? Or ARRL. Your call sign at Limark works?
Yes, I have both. KD2 Hotel, something Hotel Lima?
Lima Hotel, Alpha. I can look it up again. I have it in my send file. So, I'll send it to your call sign one. I was sending it to your vascular one. Maybe it bounced there.
For my call sign. So, KD2 Hotel Alpha Lima. Is that an HAL?
Lima Hotel Alpha. LHA. That's another one that's close to it, but it's a club call sign. It's been, I think it was LHA. I have it in my book. Very good. I'll see if I can straighten that out today. So, yeah, that's overdue, but, you know, always good to get it. That'd be a lot of fun. So, yeah, you just wrapped up and finished Anything Goes up in Holy Spirit. Went well. Everybody had a good time, so that's all that matters. Over in New Hyde Park here.
Anything Goes. Very good. My son did that last year or so. He's on White Christmas now at CM Pack in Oakdale. He finished Little Women in, what was it, Massapequa Park or someplace like that. And we were supposed to go to the last show. Wife didn't feel good. Unfortunately, we missed it. And he was the lead. I really felt bad about that. So, he's one of the dancers in White Christmas.
Exciting. Some of the guys that are in the show here are going to be in a 50 show at the Theater Westbury, the NYCB Theater. They're going to be a 50 show on the 10th. So that's some of the stars from this show. One of the guys in the show was from the Classics, was a 50s group, and they're performing in that retrospective at Westbury on the 10th. And he's bringing some of the youngsters who are in the show here over there too to be in the show with them.
Breaking station, there was a lot of noise. Unable to understand the audibility. Try again.
Satellite 6, David, Peter Zebra, Oceanside 11.
Okay, there goes the neighborhood. Go ahead, Hal. And then there's Bob over there, too.
Yeah, the X-Wave radio check. I'm waiting. I just have some equipment to take with me over CGI Electronics over the weekend, over.
You're real fuzzy right now, so I was going to switch to the input to see what I hear, but you get a chance before you stop. So let's send it around again, and we'll get, maybe you'll be able to turn the knob. N2QXI, send it over to Andy, let Hal make an adjustment, and then see if Hal's there.
Northern Parkway headed east. A couple of flakes still coming down here and there. I caught Patrick this morning on 440, and he said it was still kind of flurrying a little bit out east. And he had the same thing we did in Nassau, like a quarter inch dusting on the cars in the backyard. Nothing on the road.
Are you turning it over to me or next to rotation?
How's that, Hal? Go ahead, take a turn.
Okay, I should sound a little better right now. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Go ahead, Bob.
That was better. Very good. Red Oceanside checking in. I guess that was Patrick who was Phil's brother. I don't think you were talking to my brother, N2QXH. So, you might not have gotten on at that time. But, okay, Andy, over to you. It's my wife's side of the family takes the even years for Thanksgiving. Everybody gets together. Makes a real